Join the National U Institute for our Foundations of Freedom Regional Seminars in California. We're stopping in Newport Beach on April 30th and then in San Jose on May 1st. These half-day conferences take place from 2:30 to 6:30 p.m. and feature me, Rich Lowry, and Ramesh Panuru, along with Judge Janice Rogers Brown, John Yu of Berkeley Law, and Will Swaim of the California Policy Center. Register at nrinstitute.org. That's nrinstitute.org. Hope to see you there. Trump dodges on abortion, and will the Supreme Court lose its one and only wise Latina? We'll discuss all this and more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry. I'm joined, as always, by Noah Rothman, the sage of Authenticity Woods, Jim Garrity, and the notorious MBD, Michael Brendan Doherty. You are, of course, listening to a National podcast. Our sponsors this episode are Patriot Voices and Moink. More about both of them in due course. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, by the way, you can find us everywhere. From Spotify to iTunes, and if you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing 5-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So, Jim Garrity, we finally got Donald Trump's much-teased pronouncement on abortion yesterday. We're recording Tuesday here. I think it's fair to say it didn't please many people. He said he's a let-the-states-sort-it-out guy. He's a follow-your-heart, Jim. Follow your heart kind of guy, and a we have to win kind of guy. And he clearly, ever since Roe went down, has been deeply uncomfortable with the politics of abortion, doesn't want to talk about it, has been a little bit all over the map, occasionally talking about perhaps supporting a 15-week ban at the national level. But that is out, at least for now. What do you make of it?
You can make the argument that Donald Trump is the most consequential president for the pro-life movement of the past two generations because of the Supreme Court nominees that he got through and got onto the court that overturned Roe versus Wade. But there's always been good reason to doubt whether Donald Trump was really a pro-lifer when it counted. He'd been described himself as pro-choice earlier in life. Lots of folks have speculated whether a guy who was fairly promiscuous through the 1980s may have paid for an abortion at some point or another. But when it came time to run for the Republican nominee, Donald Trump described himself as having a conversion on the road to Damascus and described himself as pro-life. Well, he now believes, or at least in that short statement, that you know abortion is now where everybody is united from a legal standpoint, where everybody is happy, which I don't think is anywhere. It's like light years away. I don't think anybody's happy with the current status quo in abortion. If you're pro-life, you look at all the blue states that are not only making it more accessible and you know shooting down any restrictions. They're often taxpayer funding or figure out ways. Oh, we'll figure out ways to spend money to let women in states where it's a ban to get to our states so they can have those abortions. The abortion rate has actually steadily been creeping up after ironically going down through much of the Obama years. But at the same time, if you're pro-choice, you look at this like, oh my God, there's so many red states that have banned abortion. There's so many women who don't have easy access to abortion. This is terrible. So actually, nobody's really all that happy with this. I'm not surprised with what we got from Trump. And if you're not surprised, it's hard to be that disappointed. Kind of an early editor's pick. I think editorial on this one was very well written. And my salute to whoever wrote that. Wink, wink. I think this is that we should not expect a lot of movement from the Trump administration in the pro-life direction if Trump is reelected. He won't be an enemy to pro-lifers, but he certainly feels like he's done his job and he does not feel a need to expel any more time, energy, or political capital in reducing abortion in this country.
So, Noah, Trump, there's no evading this issue fundamentally. Trump will still be made to answer, one, for appointing the justices who overturned Roe. And he's not trying to disown that at all, right? That's still a bragging point for him. He says it's a great thing because all legal scholars wanted Roe overturned and the decision making to go back to the states, a slight exaggeration there, but Democrats are going to hit him on that. They're also hit him on any restriction that happens at the state level, anything that goes wrong at the state level. They'll pin on him because they say, look, you want this to be a state issue. And even if Trump wants to say, oh, you know, I wouldn't have done it that way, they'll still argue that he's responsible. And they'll say, as they've already begun saying, this is dishonest. You can't trust them. you know, as soon as he becomes president, he might shift yet again and support a national level ban. But I have to say on that one, it's a defense of Crouch, but I think it is a potentially effective defense of Crouch against that argument. Because it's a little bit like Bernie Sanders. It's one thing to be a Democrat who disavows being a socialist, who's getting accused by Republicans of being a socialist. It just makes the argument, the Republican argument, a little harder. You know, it's another thing to be a self-declared a socialist. So in a similar way, they have to argue, well, he's not saying this now, but he's going to do it once he's in office. And that's just a little tougher.
Yeah, well, that's not a new dynamic, though. It's not like Republicans don't know how to navigate a political environment informed by thorny issues around abortion. This has been part of our political dynamics for a half century. It's only a little bit different now post-Dobbs, only insofar as it's activated a lot of Democrats when it comes to fundraising, and even on the margins that turn out, particularly when abortion is on the ballot itself in the form of referenda. But it helps to navigate these issues when you're informed by genuine conviction, which Donald Trump is not. Yesterday, when Senator Lindsey Graham had the temerity to gently criticize Donald Trump's position, he unloaded, the former president, unloaded like 7 to 10 Truth Social tweets, just savaging the guy. But that wasn't even the most important aspect of what he was saying there. What he was saying was reading the stage directions aloud and skipping right to the last bullet point in the policy memo that results in the full flowering of Republican political ambition. He wrote, quote, "The states will be making the decision. Republicans are now free to run for office based on the horrible border inflation, bad economy, and death and destruction of our country." Later, quote, "I guess this means that we've won, because they," the Democrats, "are so bad on everything else that this is the only issue they're focused on." Willing, in these comments, into existence a political dynamic in which Republicans are allowed to simply ignore the issue of abortion. It's remanded to the states. It is no longer a federal election issue whatsoever, and Republicans don't have to touch it, even address it. There's political ambition here, obviously, and it has everything to do with Donald Trump's personal political brand. Since 2022, since this decision came down, Trump himself, as well as his allies, have been retailing the notion that Republicans underperform at the polls only and exclusively as a result of the post-Dobbs political environment. Trump himself said in 2022, quote, "It wasn't my fault that Republicans didn't live up to expectations in the midterms. It was the abortion issue, poorly handled by many Republicans." This is just simply false. It depends on the assumption here that Republicans only started underperforming at the polls in the fall of 2022, which is precisely backward. I've said it before and I'll say it again. In January of 2015, Republicans occupied 247 House seats, 54 seats in the Senate. They controlled 62 of this country's 99 legislative chambers. They had 33 governors and 25 trifectas. That's the point at which Republicans decided we only ever lose, and they needed a whole new cast of Republicans and a brand new ideological lodestar in order to appeal to voters. And it's been downhill ever since. And Donald Trump owns that. He owns that legacy. And he would love nothing more than to have another narrative to offload his own movement's underperformance at the polls. This is what this represents for him. Yeah, it's a moonshot to try to get around the abortion issue without actually having to dwell on it or deal with it. But it's also a exercise in branding, and a rather transparent one at that. He's making no effort to retail it as anything other than personal branding.
So MBD, Marjorie Dannenfelser, and the Susan B. Anthony Fund, a very prominent pro-life group, expressed major disappointment with this right out of the gate, but said, look, we still need to defeat Joe Biden. Other pro-life leaders, they barely even expressed any disappointment. And besides Lindsey Graham, it's not many Republicans, Mike Pence an exception, have been vocal about this. And I've been with Graham. You know, I think it makes sense for the party to have a unified position they can defend. 15-week ban is pretty popular in the polling, and just kind of go with that and stick with that. But in a presidential election, if that is your position, Democrats are going to say, look, you want to wipe away every pro-choice law in every state in the country. So you definitely, there's political risk there, even if you have an affirmative position that you feel as though you can really plant your feet in and defend. And part of what's going on here is just Republicans they're so scared. They haven't, there's no unified party position. There's just scattering in all directions. And Trump is as much a symptom of that as a cause.
Yeah. I mean, I think this issue has scared Republicans for a long time, right? I mean, there's been all sorts of historical dancing around where, you know, people are like, I'm pro-life, but my wife is pro-choice. So focus on that. Or, people being terrified since Todd Akin, his candidacy went down in flames in, what was it, 2010 or 2012? When he kind of stepped on it in this issue. Republicans have to just get mature and get behind a stance. I'm a little afraid of the national stance by Lindsey Graham, because I'm afraid if you have a so-called 15-week ban where you allow all abortions up to 15 weeks, and then you add on Trump's exceptions, rape, incest, life of the mother, and you define them expansively as they usually are.
Like life of the mother is defined as health, which is defined in a vague way. And
it could be defined as mental health or financial health. The way it's been stretched at the ground level has been, shocking. I mean, in effect, you're almost recreating Roe at that point under the guise of passing a restriction. So I think that's actually a present danger that the pro-life movement has to begin girding itself to avoid if Trump wins and he gets enough Republicans who want to sign on for it. I somehow doubt that's going to happen in the Senate.
So what do you think of Dan McLaughlin's point that, the main thing now is just defending state level prohibitions and protections of unborn life. So we shouldn't be thinking that much about the national level. It's not going to happen. There's not going to be any national pro-life legislation passed. So just focus on this. This is the practical thing. This is the thing that's saving some lives. So it's not wrong to make this the main battleground.
I think it's not wrong to make this the main battleground, but I'm very open to more creative approaches. Like, J.D. Vance this week has been talking about his interest in a make birth free style legislation where, the government essentially pays for healthcare of mothers giving birth. This is sort of a major rethink that you have to do generationally, I think, about where you're sluicing the money. If we're going to continue to sluice it towards the villages in Florida and the giant retirement party going on down there.
Yeah, we'll sluice it both places. So that'd be one of the arguments against this. But MBD, is the argument there that shows you're pro mother, pro nature?
Shows that you're not just saying I'm pro birth and get around that argument, and also just I think JD also wants to address issues of demographic decline and fertility decline generally and thinks maybe there's a way to create culturally more support for mothers having babies and forming families. He gave a very funny personal anecdote about it, which is that Americans are often confronted with these catastrophic financial decisions in the middle of a birth where he had one where his wife was asked to pick an anesthesiologist just while she was undergoing labor. And she happened to pick the wrong one out of network, which ended up costing them, $20,000 more. And that's a thing that tons of people face. And it is, I'm sure, at some level, a drag on fertility when you face that kind of financial uncertainty, or when a hospital stay could be just $15,000.
Hospital bills are incredibly arbitrary. Jim Garrity, exit question to you, sheer politics. Rate how much Trump has reduced his vulnerability on abortion politically from 0% to 100%. 0%, it did nothing, not going to move the needle, makes no difference. 100%, this really completely defangs Biden's attacks against him on this issue. And I guess you can go negative if you think he's hurt himself.
No, I'd probably 25%, maybe 30. Last week I was on Chris Wallace's program, and one of the questions was, will Trump thread the needle on his statement on abortion? And I remember thinking, like, Trump never threads the needle. He always just kind of rampages across the landscape, just blurting out the first thing that pops into his head and then raging on. So, but you know what? That never really seems to hurt him. He very rarely suffers some terrible consequence for saying something incendiary or not deftly handling or wording things correctly about an issue. So, I don't think it's not that I don't think abortion is going to be an issue in 2024. First of all, I just think, you know, stuff like the economy is going to be a bigger deal. And I think a lot of this was priced in with Trump. I don't really see it as being a major impediment to compared to everything else that he brings to the table.
What's priced in? Trump not being a true pro-lifer or Trump being
both? Whatever option number two is, yes.
That's priced in.
Yeah, that people know that Trump is.
That's a key axiom for this election, right?
Yeah. Everybody believes that he's either pragmatic or unprincipled, whichever term you prefer.
Yeah. Noah.
Very much agree with Jim's assessment that voters generally understand that Donald Trump is unmoored to conviction and will say whatever is most politically advantageous. And in a vacuum, this position that he's carved out for himself is the most politically advantageous. It doesn't annoy as many Republicans as it could, and it sort of neutralizes some of the attacks that the left will bring. What worries me and what I think should worry Republicans is the degree to which Donald Trump leapt at the opportunity to prosecute an argument against a fellow Republican with as much vigor as he could possibly muster. That is where the energy is within his movement. It is hostile to intra-party dynamics. It is very uncomfortable being part of a coalition with heterogeneous views. And insofar as it's part of a blame-shifting exercise, and I think it is, for what the ultimate outcome is in November, it's not going to be the last we'll see. There will be many other intra-Republican disputes that have that kind of passion.
Yeah, so there's definitely the blame-shifting is part of this. They, you know, want to blame abortion for Republican difficulties. But Trump is, it's interesting, right? Because here he is on a matter of the highest import and a really important substantive issue, and he's totally flexible and is just going to go where the pragmatic politics wherever the pragmatic politics point.
Which tells you where it shifted from 2016 when he signed a letter signing on to Lindsey Graham's proposed 20-week abortion ban at the national level.
Yeah, so there he needed to the politics where he needed to reassure pro-lifers, and the politics of abortion were different then as well. But if you cross him personally, that's where it doesn't matter what the pragmatic thing to do. It doesn't matter what the politics are. It doesn't matter if it would be smarter not to attack Nikki Haley or smarter not to go after Lindsey Graham, hammer and tongs. Not that I think that, you know, this episode is going to Trump versus Graham on this is going to matter very much. But that's where he can't control himself.
Rich, I'm sorry, this is a bit of a digression. We're in the middle of an exit question, but Nick Attagio over at The Dispatch had an interesting point that this might neutralize some of the dictator arguments because he's advocating devolution of power to the states.
I guess so.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, I don't know, but it seems like a very interesting formulation if the former president could embrace it.
Yeah, but all the dictator stuff, they still got a lot of other dictator arguments against them, right?
Anybody who thinks Trump is an aspiring dictator is not going to. Oh, okay. So on abortion is cool. All right, never mind. Hey, everybody.
We have two 25 to 35% on the board.
How does the percentage work again? It's
it's very simple, MBD. So it's 0% if Trump hasn't neutralized it at all, and it's 100% if he's totally neutralized it.
I think he's about 50%. I think he has, I'm sorry to say, I think he has calculated correctly that he does not face a serious revolt on his among evangelical voters and other pro-life activists, that they are the most loyal group to him at this point. And I think he's calculated correctly that it's more moderates that need reassurance. And he gave them that. I mean, and I think it fits with his political persona better than pretending to be an all-out pro-lifer. And the only thing I think he can't solve, and what is, you know, as we say, priced in, is that a lot of people just view him as cynical and convictionless, and they don't, that repulses them as much as anything.
So repulses. So is that a benefit to him or a downside?
Well, no, I think it's a downside among, but it's mostly a downside among voters who are already predisposed not to like him, right? It's like, oh, well, he's trying to reassure me on abortion, but I don't actually believe him. I think the crazy moral majority will get their way anyway.
So, I mean, I think one of the benefits of Trump politically, one of the advantages, I should say, is that, you know, since 16, he wins because he's more moderate in some ways, you know, and I think that he still has that quality, right? Yeah. A totally immoderate persona that is relatively moderate on some substantive questions. So let me further digress within this exit question. Anyone have any, what would be the thing that Trump could do or say that would cause the balance of opinion on the right to say, shouldn't have done that. That's too far. You've betrayed us.
Judges. He would go back on the very people who engineered the Dobbs decision. That's why he can't run away from it.
Yeah. So if he said, you know, I'm just picking, no more ideological litmus tests. I'm just picking the best people I like most.
And that's what his movement wants.
That would be a red line.
The movement that wants him to abandon the Federalist Society because they're not mm-hmm. up to the, you know, the scale of the challenges that which we're confronted with today, with their originalism and their appeals to the Constitution, blah, blah, blah. We need people with vigor and energy and the will to do what needs to be done. I mean, if he goes that direction, I think there would be a significant backlash among people who subscribe to conservatism as we understand it.
You guys agree with that, Jim, MBD?
I was going to say that if Trump fully reverted back to the 1980s, 1990s style New York City Democrat that he was, particularly on an issue like guns, then you see people abandoning him. But there's so much folks who, you know, like, there are certain issues, if you want to be the Republican presidential nominee, they're just non-negotiable. And I think abortion and guns are probably one and two. But on everything else, I think everybody's proven to be willing to follow him, straight to hell.
Yeah, so Trump also, you know, totally unconventional, obviously, but it was a very conventional play when you get down to the fundamentals on this, where he dances around, teases that he's going to go right on this issue during the primaries, although not entirely right, because he attacks the DeSantis 6-week ban. But then once he has a nomination sewed up, then goes to this relatively moderate, let the states decide position. So with that, let's hear from our first sponsor this episode, Moink. If you listen to this show, you know we all love Moink. This is a totally sincere passion. We all love when the Moink boxes show up at our front door. We all love the product. We often have competitions who's going to endorse Moink in a given ep when Moink is a sponsor. So Moink is a wonderful product. And 60% of U.S. pork production comes from one company owned by the Chinese. And their hogs are given something called ractopamine, which is banned in 160 countries, including China. Yet you find it in your grocery aisle every day. There's a better way, which is another reason we want to tell you about Moink. That's Moo plus Moink. Moink delivers grass-fed and grass-finished beef and lamb, pastured pork and chicken, and sustainable wild-caught Alaskan salmon straight to your door. Moink farmers farm like our grandparents did, and as a result, Moink meat tastes like it should because the family farm does it better. The Moink difference is a difference you can taste, and you can feel good knowing you're helping family farms stay financially independent too. You choose the meat delivered in every box, like ribeyes or chicken breast or pork chops or salmon fillets and much more. Plus, you can cancel anytime. Shark Tank host Kevin O'Leary called Moink's bacon the best bacon he's ever tasted. And Ring doorbell founder Jamie Simimoff jumped at the chance to invest in Moink. Plus, they guarantee you'll say, oink, oink, I'm so happy I got Moink, that is definitely the reaction we have here at the Lowry household. It's an event when a Moink box shows up at the door. It's just a cool, it's packaged in a cool way, and the meat is fantastic. So keep American farming going by signing up at moinkbox.com/editors right now. And listeners of this show get free bacon for a year. Are you kidding me? Free bacon for a year. That's 1 year of the best bacon you'll ever taste, but for a limited time. Spelled moinkbox.com/editors. That's moinkbox.com/editors. Moinkbox.com/editors. Please check it out. So Noah, Biden has been completely bound and determined to forgive student loan debt. He got rebuked by the Supreme Court in an obviously illegal executive action to do one form of this debt forgiveness, and he's back again. What do you make of it?
Yeah, he sure is. So the attempt to do a very sweeping debt forgiveness plan was halted by the Supreme Court. And since then, the administration has been going piecemeal in the effort to forgive as much debt as they can without apparently running afoul of the Supreme Court order, although it's kind of vague as to whether the OLC, the Office of Legal Counsel in the White House, has managed to do that to the satisfaction of the courts, yet to be seen. But so far, he's been forgiving debt to the tune of, $5,000 here, $10,000 there. It has to do with how much principal you owe relative, or how much interest you owe relative to the principal. And so roughly 30 million Americans are captured in these debt forgiveness schemes to one degree or another. And what's interesting is we've been at this game for almost 2 years now, at least 18 months. And what does the White House have to show for it? What are the fruits that they're enjoying for this naked pander to the degree holders that have become the foremost leg in the stool of the Democratic coalition, this top-heavy coalition with people who have 4-year degrees, graduate degrees, PhDs, what have you? I can't see it. I mean, sure, the coalition is becoming far more dependent on degree holders. Degree holders are gravitating towards the Democratic Party, but the alternative is that they have been repulsing a far larger host, people without degrees, who of all races, ethnicities, and genders have been gravitating more towards the Republican Party. And the people he intended to quiet, and we all know who they were, it was the young people. It was the people who are currently enrolled, matriculated students, or recent graduates who are very loud and vocal in their opposition to Joe Biden and were way before Israel was attacked on October 7th. They don't regard him as sufficiently progressive, committed to their ideas, generally incapable of adopting their outlook on the world just by virtue of his age and his infirmities and where his his worldview is. And I just don't understand why they're so committed to this, given how much it has seemingly not had the effect that it was desired to have. Not backfired necessarily, not necessarily enlivened opposition to this plan to the point where you're seeing, on paper at least in polling, a significant threat to the Democratic Party's bottom line as a result of antipathy towards Joe Biden's debt forgiveness schemes. But you haven't seen a lot of young people come out and say, well, I got to put my qualms aside. He forgave $5,000 in student loan debt that I had. And why would they? When you think about it that way, why would they? It's piecemeal. It's not something that they're ultimately going to notice or certainly have, profound affection for Joe Biden for doing. And he runs afoul of the courts in the process. So it seems like this whole strategy entails far more risk than reward. They're incurring all these risks and not a lot of reward, and yet they're keeping at it. You can only assume that's because Joe Biden is surrounded by people who are degree holders who really want their debts forgiven, or at least the people in their social circles really want to be able to say this and absorb the gratitude from the people they go to have three martini lunches with. Because otherwise, I don't see it. I don't see what the benefit is.
So, Jim, we're going to go to you because that was a three martini lunch reference. That's Jim's other podcast venture, if you don't know. So just lowest common denominator politics, though, Jim, you look at these polls, and they're kind of incredible. The erosion among Blacks and Latinos, which is one thing, but the erosion among young progressives is another. And if you're looking at that and you're worried about that and you want to rectify that in November, the two blunderbuss, at least things that you would do, doesn't mean they're deft or going to work, would be you wobble on the Gaza war, at least, or play around with the idea of dumping Israel that's so hateful to so many young people, and find some way to forgive student loans.
This really feels a lot like the old anecdote about the drunk who's looking for his keys under the lamppost. And, you know, they say, well, did you lose your keys over there? He's like, no. Well, why are you looking over there? Well, because the light is better over here. This is if you looked at the way Joe Biden has approached his presidency going back to January 20th, 2021, you would think that student loan debt was the single biggest problem facing the country. Maybe I'm exaggerating a little, but there's just an enormous amount of tension, enormous amount of time, energy, political capital, and effort put into this. And, you know, I'm sure I don't begrudge anybody who's having some of their student loan debt forgiven for enjoying it, and celebrating it, and saying, "Oh, this is good news." But really, you know, you ask me what keeps you up awake, what keeps you awake at night, Jim? Chinese invasion of Taiwan, national debt, lack of entitlement reform, Russia storming through Ukraine and moving on to the Baltics. You know, like there's a long list of Iranian nuclear weapon. Yeah, like there's a lot of things in this world. The border, there's a lot of problems. And yet this administration has convinced itself that the two biggest problems it faces are not enough people are getting forgiveness for their student loans after not having to pay them for like 3 years during the pandemic, let's remember, and that they're, you know, too friendly to Israel. And that somehow, if they just do enough public stances of opposing Israel, then everybody in Dearborn's going to vote for them, and the Muslim Americans, the Arab Americans, and the Palestinian Americans will come back. And they'll win the state of Michigan and everything will be fine. That is, you know, no, that's not really what's got Joe Biden in trouble. What's got Joe Biden in trouble is that he's older than dirt. Everything's really expensive. And, you know, we've had a policy that amounts to de facto open borders for the past 3 years. If he did things about that, I mean, he can't do anything about his age, but if he did something on those issues, his numbers would be much, much better. But instead, because the average young progressive who's either working in the Biden administration or has the ear of the Biden administration is really upset about Israel and having to pay back student loans that they signed a contract promising to pay back. That's what bothers them the most. And I just kind of, you know, if people conclude that Biden's presidency has been a failure, and I think he's well on the road to that conclusion at this point, it will be that in the end, Biden worried about the wrong problems and they all caught up to him.
Mm-hmm. So MBD, the first plan went down. I think it was supposed to forgive some or all the debt for 40 million borrowers, and it was using this thing called the Heroes Act, which is, you know, it was if your town was wiped out by a tornado and you can't get a job for 6 months and you fell behind on your debt payments, it could be forgiven, you know, because of the incredible circumstances. And then they wanted to apply that on the basis of everyone having gone through COVID to 40 million people, and the court said, no, that doesn't fly. And now they're going to use the Higher Education Act and exceptions in there. But again, it's applying to 30 million people. So if Congress intended for this to happen, Congress would have and should have passed a law saying, you know what, you can forgive student debt for 30 million people. Instead, they're trying to use all these little carve-outs and exceptions and motivated readings, interpretations of the law. And even if this passes muster eventually with the Supreme Court, this is not how the system's supposed to work.
No, not at all. And it's not supposed to work that way because we're supposed to, you know, our government is supposed to be accountable to the public, and the president just giving away blandishments ahead of election time is not, you know, by, you know, using his pen and phone, that's not how it's supposed to work. And there's a reason Democrats in the House and Senate don't think they can get something like this through, because it's so regressive in the way it, you know, most student loans are held by people with advanced degrees, people like doctors and lawyers who are high earners. There are a lot of people who are weighed down by student loans. And I actually think, addressing student loans is a totally legitimate issue. It's just, we're doing it exactly the wrong way by just giving debt forgiveness to a giant, almost random set of borrowers, when in fact we should be tackling the fact that the way federal subsidies of student loans work allow colleges to raise tuition at like several times the rate of inflation, where, you know, now it's like, whatever, $60,000 to go to a mid-tier school for undergraduate education. It's almost the median wage in most states. It's an absurdity, and it's used to fund a giant, I mean, Republicans should point out that this is really a bailout for a giant bloated administrative class that's grown like cancer in most colleges. It's your DEI bureaucracies that are actually getting the relief here, because the pressure to bring college prices down is being lifted by this stupid promise of debt forgiveness. So, you know, this is like, you know, Republicans should go at this as like the scam that it is that Democrats are trying to make up to one constituency for the largesse they're spraying on another one. And it's, you know, like, it's a crime.
So, Jim Garrity, Joe Biden totters up to you, says, Mr. Garrity, I hear you're a great political analyst, and I want you to tell me, be honest, the one thing I can do, if there's just one thing I can do at the moment to appreciably increase my chances of winning in November, what do you tell him? What's that one thing?
I'm going to restore as many of the Trump-era restrictions on people entering the country illegally as possible, including remain in Mexico, including construction of new border fencing that was authorized under the previous administration. I will be, that basically we will be, the entire approach to asylum will be much more skeptical, and the entire process will be designed, you know, like we want to make it as fast as possible up to and including a drive-through lane, considering the backlogs have some people waiting for court dates in the year 2033. Because what we have here is basically people come, you know, they cross the border illegally. They say border patrol. They say, I'm seeking asylum. They say that we've got, you know, gangs in my community or something. And the current system is say, okay, come back in at least 4 years, maybe six, maybe nine. And in the meantime, they're in this legal limbo where they're living in the United States. You wonder why we're, you know, seeing squatters. Why are we seeing, you know, so many socials, services strained to the breaking point? It's because we've got like a couple million more people than we had just a few years ago. Most of whom came here with just the shirts on their back, who are desperate for help. What did you think the consequences were going to be? And then I'd probably start berating Biden, and he'd yell at me and call me corn pop.
No, what's the one thing?
So Jim's answer is better than mine. I'll just say that up front, in policy terms. But mine is not policy at all. It would be politics. I don't know why Joe Biden has not spent any of the capital, the political capital he banks among Democrats and his progressives for doing every single thing they ask of him and gets nothing in return. It's time to spend some of that capital. And I would do it by taking one expendable member of the squad, say Jamal Bowman, and throwing him under the bus. Everything he's advocated for with regard to Israel, Hamas, all his spending priorities, which are wildly out of step with what we can actually afford, what have you, and say, this guy's nuts. This guy and what he believes is nuts. It's not what I believe. It's not what my party believes, and it's certainly not sustainable for the future of the country.
Some excuse to do this?
Yeah, well, I mean, because Jamal Bowman is on the bubble here when it comes to, I mean, you could do Rashida Tlaib, you could do AOC, but I mean, there would be a lot more backlash for that sort of thing, and you wouldn't get the desired remedy because they're still going to be around for probably a very long time.
Taking out, like, you're primarying him. You're supporting his primary opponent?
That's right, yeah. Say, I'm going to back George Latimer, who's his primary opponent, a Democratic county executive. The trade-off there is advantageous for Democrats, and at the same time, you get to say all this wild nonsense that the progressive squad believes, whatever that may be, is not what I believe, and it's not what I think the Democratic Party should stand for.
I think you're way too modest. I think that's a good answer. Might even be better than Jim's. I'll let the listeners decide. MVD.
I think Joe Biden has to show he has spine. Like Noah said, but I would say I think he should show it on Israel first. I think this total collapse of his administration into just limply demanding that Israelis somehow effect a total ceasefire and bring back the hostages, without mentioning that Hamas is holding them and fighting, is just and
rejecting every ceasefire and killing these people in their custody.
And it's insanity. And he should be out there vocally demanding the release of the American hostages from Hamas and promising serious consequences if they're not released. And then, you know, if he shows a little backbone there, then yeah, show other like Biden-esque backbone elsewhere. You know, I mean, for me, I would like go and say, I want all of the regulatory burdens on the CHIPS Act gone. I don't want to be worried about daycares when I'm trying to get industrial policy going where we make advanced chips in America again. The focus is on chip making and the jobs, not on daycare centers near the place that are holding it up. Mm-hmm. So drop all that stuff and get to work on the real issue.
So I'm going to totally endorse Jim's inferior answer. I think the answer is clearly the border and the stuff that Jim outlined would make a difference, which would be important. But even if he just wants to do theatrical stuff that doesn't make a difference, I think that would help a lot too. I mean, just get some cranes going and putting up structure, you know, and go there with a hard hat or send Mayor Pete with a hard hat to say, look at this incredible wall we're building. Whatever it is, do something rather than just sit around and deny this problem or blame Republicans. So with that, it's time for our second sponsor of this episode. This is a message from our sponsor, Patriot Voices. Here's a simple thought. Parents matter. After all, who knows what's better for children, their parents or bureaucrats? Do you know what's best for your child, or do bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. have your child's best interests at heart? The answer is obvious. Parents matter. Right now, Congress is advancing a bill called the Kids Online Safety Act. This bill would strip parents of their decision-making authority if bureaucrats at the Federal Trade Commission decide that a Christian video or homeschooling site is quote unquote dangerous or quote unquote unscientific. Your family won't be able to access that material on the internet. Kids will be banned from seeing content online that the government deems dangerous. But the government's definition of what poses a threat to your child very likely is not your definition. If you believe parents matter, join Patriot Voices in opposing this takeover of parents' authority. Go to patriotvoices.com for more information and to take action. Again, that's patriotvoices.com. Very simple. Patriotvoices.com because parents matter. So, MBD, we've been talking here for about 45 minutes, and now we're finally going to get to the main outrage the last week or 10 days. There's one wise Latina on the Supreme Court, MBD, just one, and they're trying to take her out. You have liberal opinion makers saying that Sonia Sotomayor, who's only 70 years old, who maybe, I guess, just has diabetes or something, but seems totally fine, that she, out of all the justices, including a lot of white justices and male justices, she's the one who has to retire. What do you make of it?
Well, what I make of it is that Democrats' formative trauma about the Supreme Court is that they cheered Ruth Bader Ginsburg until she went into the grave under Donald Trump, with the election looming. That was horrible for them. They saw the Supreme Court finally definitively swing to the right. And they've been nuts ever since. And so of course they're looking at
almost, it's hard for me to stop laughing just thinking about it. Literally. I mean, she'd nod off during the State of the Union and everyone would be going, "Oh, she's so awesome."
Routine. They literally were promoting her workout routines.
Yeah.
And listen, Sotomayor is, anyway, that trauma is as formatory as it was for Republicans when we saw Souter appointed, right? It was like, oh, this can never happen again. We have to find a way out of this. So we're going to, you know, will 86 Justice Myers, you know, ahead of time under the Bush administration, just to make sure this never, ever happens again. We want them vetted by Leonard Leo, and that's it. And, you know, Sotomayor, though, is, you know, running a potential risk. I mean, Stephen Breyer is 85 and still living. So 70 is not necessarily a death sentence. But, and in fact, it's kind of young, and it's kind of, you know, a short term for her, given her age.
Kind of snuck up on me. I didn't realize she was 70.
Even her, but given her age and when she was appointed, this would be a kind of cutting it short. If you're, if you want to build a legacy, even a legacy of dissents, I think she kind of does want to build that legacy given how her writing has gone the last 5 years.
Yeah.
It's kind of in a strange direction, I would say. And one that's, sui generis or impossible to replace.
Yeah, I guess so.
I mean, you know, you know, it's sort of like, I don't know. She's, yeah. I mean, people remember the Chevy. People remember the Chevy Nova, right? And I think people will remember Sonia Sotomayor kind of the same way. So,
Supreme Court Justice.
So yeah. Listen. I wonder if the bullying will work. Honestly, I think I absolutely think she's part of the class of people who are sensitive to this, and sensitive to mainstream media pressure and the hive mind. She absolutely knows that Josh Barrow and Nate Silver have written about this. And she will be thinking about, her reputation, but you know, if she feels in good health, I mean, Donald Trump is not, eligible to run in 2028. So she's not necessarily facing, 8 years of Republican rule, even if Donald Trump wins.
So, Jim, it's not quite a full hive mind, but Josh Barrow did this on a Substack, and then an Atlantic piece, and then Nate Silver yesterday had a big, I think it was yesterday, had a big piece himself. But I think they're totally right. Of course she should retire, and I'm not sure whether either of them said this, but she's not very impressive Supreme Court justice. It's not like she's irreplaceable. At least Ginsburg was, you know, a kind of legal giant. No one is ever going to say that about Sonia Sotomayor. And 70 is not ancient these days, but there is some risk if Trump wins.
Rich, I won't give much grief to Barrow or Silver. They both have decades of punditry ahead of them. But the one that jumped out at me was when the declaration that it's time for Sotomayor to retire, or the nudging her towards the exit, came from Connecticut Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal.
Yeah, now how old is he?
78. He's nine years older.
I ran into him on a train, and he looks 78.
Yes.
If you see him in person, not you know, he has this sort of carved out of granite kind of visage, but he's an old guy.
Look, you know, he's blooming. So you have a 78-year-old guy telling the 69-year-old, "You're too old to stay in your important government job." Now, look, a lot of 78-year-old men get confused. Maybe Blumenthal's having flashbacks to Nam. But anyway, by the way, I made that joke in a corner post.
You've been saving that up all week.
No, I did it in a corner post, and somebody's like, "I cannot believe you're bringing back the stereotype of Vietnam veterans having mental health problems." And I'm like, Google is your friend. Blumenthal did not serve in Vietnam. Like he got some real stolen valor grief about this. So I would not make fun of Vietnam veterans. I would make fun of a fake Vietnam veteran. That's what, you know. Look, 69 is middle-aged for Supreme Court justices. The average I've got a column coming up on this. The average retirement age for a Supreme Court justice from 1971 to 2006 was 78.7 years old. John Paul Stevens retired in 2010 when he was 90. And yet,
so are you saying, Jim, you're not being sarcastic?
No,
she shouldn't go.
I think Sonia Sotomayor has every reason to say, "Stick it where the sun don't shine." And if anybody's going to give me grief about this, it sure as hell better not be Blumenthal or President Biden. You know, our president who turns 82 right after the election. Sonia Mayer's mother, by the way, lived to be 94. Like, there's no reason to think that she's going to keel over in the next couple of years.
All right. All right. So Jim is quite sincerely pushing back against us. Noah, where are you?
So I'm going to say that I just don't see this idea catching on, really. With the exception of Senator Blumenthal, who's the exception that proves the rule, the people who are lobbying for this sort of thing are the bedwetter caucus, as Democrats define them. They're the people who don't believe Joe Biden is going to win. They see the polls as moving in a straight line trajectory. They have no confidence in Democrats to make up the ground they've lost. Therefore, they are they demonstrated insufficient zeal and vigor for the cause, and they're not going to be amassing a lot of support for what they want to happen. And if they did get what they wanted to happen, they might soon regret it, because we'd be looking at a confirmation fight in an election year over a replacement level liberal justice who would certainly sow division within Democrats and progressives, depending on who was picked, and would unify Republicans and animate Republicans in ways that they are not yet animated, smooth over a lot of divisions that, regardless of what you think, how prominent they will be in November, are present today. So I just don't see the idea having a lot of attraction once you actually begin to game it out, not from the people who are advocating for it or what the consequences would be. My personal preference, should she leave? No, I don't think she should leave. I don't want her to leave. I want her to subsequently have to vacate office when there's a Republican in the White House. That'd be my ideal.
So MBD, exit question to you. Let's stick with the court and hypothetical. So Biden is reelected, but Republicans take the Senate and there is a vacancy on the right side of the court. Would the Senate, a Republican Senate, confirm a Biden nominee?
They'd be looking at the polling very nervously, depending on how early it is, about keeping a seat open for 3 years or more, or at least 2 years. I think they keep it open.
So they would not confirm.
They would not confirm any Biden nominee.
Jim Garrity.
To make sure I understand the question, Biden's reelected. Yeah. Republican Senate,
yeah.
Biden nominee.
Yeah. For a conservative justice. Yeah. And let's say it's like a month in, something terrible happens. Will they keep it open through the entirety of the Biden presidency, assuming they hold the Senate?
I think what you would see is what I would have preferred to see during the whole Merrick Garland thing, is that they would go through with hearings. They would go through with treating the nominee as one. And then when push came to shove, said, yeah, no, I don't like this guy, and vote it down and wait for the next one. And they would go through this process and constantly find good reasons to reject that one, unless Biden, nominated the most, I'm going to say centrist, but I don't know if it's the best term, but the single most, somebody who would represent a significant move to the right from whichever liberal justice is being replaced. If it's conservative justice, then I think, yeah, you go through this process over and over again, and the court has eight justices for a long stretch.
Noah.
I mean, I struggle to imagine what the conservative justice would look like that Joe Biden would nominate. But nevertheless,
so conservative justice goes down and there's an opening.
I understand now.
Would the Senate confirm a Biden nominee?
It very much depends on who the nominee is. I really frankly think that what the vetting process would look like and what committee hearings would look like would matter a lot. But before the midterms, yeah, I think they would confirm without a whole lot of drama, actually. And after the midterms, depending on how close we are to the election, yeah, I suspect they would, but there would be a little bit more, there would be a little bit more tension there. But yeah, I suspect they would confirm the nominee.
I think the impulse would be no, and the initial intention would be no. I just think it'd be very hard to sustain for years. And I do think at that point, you're getting towards a fundamental breakdown of the process. This court can go on with eight justices, but it's I think at that point, it's really getting a little crazy. And I think they would end up relenting and confirming some Biden nominee at some point. With that, let me do a quick plug for NR Plus. If you're not already a subscriber, you gotta become one. It's a really important way to support our journalism. We need people to pay a little bit, not a lot, but a little bit for what they read at nationalreview.com. So if you appreciate what we produce, if you're reading it regularly, please stop being a freeloader and join tens of thousands of your fellow National Review readers as a member of NR Plus today, tomorrow, or the day after, or even if you have to, the day after that. But please sign up. It is, in all seriousness, very important to us. With that, let's hit a few other things before we go. MBD, you've been reading Roald Dahl books with your kids.
I have been with my sons now. I've read some of them in the past with my daughter, but my sons are at the right age, and it's, you know, sometimes hard to find the right children's books. They're either they're just reading for reading's sake, and they don't really grip the kids. But Roald Dahl always grips my children. So The Fantastic Mr. Fox, James and the Giant Peach, Matilda, these are all working for us. And it's just great to find books that my kids then ask me, you know, to read instead of like asking me for a screen or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so I'm very thankful for that legacy he leaves us, even if he's a kind of strange, problematic figure in himself, but the books are great.
There you go. Jim Garrity, you did some yard work and may never be the same.
Yeah. So I know in the past editions of this podcast, I know Michael has written his ode to mowing the lawn. I know Noah has talked about the joys of yard work. And I just want to say, are you guys crazy? This past weekend, so I live in a forest, basically. And every year they dump just tons of leaves down on them.
You live in Authenticity Woods.
Authenticity Woods. Yes, it comes with that. And oh, by the way, ran into snakes while doing yard work this past weekend.
Wow. Garter snake?
I saw a garden snake, really small, non-venomous. By the way, there's a difference between venomous and poisonous. If you have teenagers, that will remind you of these sorts of things. My wife saw...
What's the difference between venomous and poisonous?
So venomous means like it puts the venom into you, right? Like it's in the fangs and it injects it. Uh-huh. Poisonous means like if you ate the meat of the snake, it would kill you. I know it's going to shock people. I work out, I do elliptical, I lift weights and stuff like that. But whatever I'm doing, it was not preparing me for bending over, picking up leaves and putting them into leaf bags, because I am feeling it in my lower back, in my shoulders, in my hips, in my ankles. How am I sore in my ankles? So yeah, the temptation to hire a landscaping company gets more and more each year.
So Noah, you enjoyed the eclipse.
Sort of. Well, I enjoyed the fanfare around it. Pulled the kids out of school about 30 minutes early. Some of my neighbors, we got them up to the top of the hill.
Of course, 100 neighbors, you and 100 neighbors.
No. You don't even know. It was branded, Rich. This was a branded event. Wine sips and solar eclipse.
I expect nothing else of your neighborhood.
That's right, and it has to run.
And as well organized and as social a neighborhood as you know it. But
so we did. Yeah, it was a smaller gathering than maybe 100 people, but nevertheless, got up to the top of the hill where my neighbors have this. Like they built this series of. It's like kind of a shed, but it's stacked on top of a shed, and that's the top of the hill. So it's like a treehouse, though there are no trees to be seen. And we all got up there and watched what we could of the eclipse until an evil black cloud descended on us and blocked the maximum. So we didn't actually see the most of the eclipse, but we got enough of it. And the eclipse was really just an excuse, let's be honest.
Yeah, well, it's we're in a weird place in our country. The one thing that unites everyone is their enjoyment of the sun being blotted out. So I went to Yankees opening day, and I've kind of come to what I enjoy most about going to Yankee games is getting in early and going and hanging out near the bullpen. And, you know, these guys will talk to people. They haven't talked to me, but they'll talk to people close to me. And this game, Austin Wells, the Yankee rookie catcher, was out there. I'd never seen a catcher do warm-ups or do drills. So this was a real close-up with him getting shot fastballs out of the pitching machine, and the I presume was the catching coach working with them. And I sent a video of this to Andy McCarthy, who knows a lot about catching because his son is a catcher in college baseball, and Andy pointed out to me what they were working on, which is a way if you start with your glove high and then go down low, you're unlikely to get a favorable call from umpires because they just feel that that's a ball, even if it's a strike. So what you want to do is start with your glove low and go high. And that tends to produce more favorable calls from umpires. I don't think any of this should be an issue. I think there should be a laser strike zone so catchers don't have to be so concerned with trying to fool the umpires. But anyway, that's what Austin Wells was working on. He projects to be a pretty good left-handed hitter in Yankee Stadium, but his defense is still a question mark. So it's good that he was out there in the bullpen working on this early. With that, it's time for editor's picks. MBD, what's your pick?
My pick is a piece by Abigail Anthony on the site Sex at Birth. Basically, this Abigail is taking on this weird phrase that's cropped up into medical life, sex assigned at birth. And she points out others have pointed out the problem with assigned, the idea that doctors are assigning rather than recognizing sex at birth. But she kind of takes on the at birth part and points out that obvious fact we all know, which is that sex precedes birth. It's determined at conception. We can recognize it as early as, 8 weeks, with certainty by 13 weeks. And we know this even legally because, you can sue a fertility clinic for implanting the wrongly sexed embryo. In China, you can obtain an abortion because the embryo inside of you is the wrong sex. Abigail's piece is pretty definitive.
Jim Garrity, what's your pick?
One of the pieces that feels so simple and yet so necessary by our Jessica Hornick, Remember the Hostages. I'm just kind of going through and listing Keith Siegel, Hirsch Goldberg Poland, Eden Alexander, Omer Neutra, Sagul, Dekel Chen, forgive me if I've mispronounced them. There are American hostages in the hands of Hamas, and you'd think this would be a big story that we would get reminded of on a regular basis, and it feels like the coverage of this, never mind comparable to the 1980 Iran hostage crisis. It just feels like it's been missing from so much of the news cycle. You figure those names would have been household names by now, and they're not. So I'm really thankful that Jessica wrote that. It is very important. I hope everybody checks it out.
Noah.
So Jessica's piece was my pick as well. a very important and simple, but critical act of journalistic hygiene that has just otherwise been absent from our national discourse. But Jim did a good job identifying why you should read that. So I'm just going to put in another plug, as Jim did earlier in this podcast, for our editorial on Donald Trump's abortion comments. Trump's Abortion Hedge is the title. A lot of very interesting and salient observations in there. Perhaps the one that I think needs to be tagged and emphasized is the degree to which the former president is seeking for himself a political out for a lot of bad outcomes, which is a very cynical way to manipulate an issue that is so extremely important. So go read that.
So my pick is a corner post by our friend Jeff Blehar. You're fine just where you are, Sonia Sotomayor. And he says, quote, I want to reach out to Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor and give her some 100% sincere advice that I hope she takes to heart. You're fine right where you are, Slay Queen. Please do not listen to all those negative Nellies and Bean County bigots telling you to resign from the Supreme Court immediately while Democrats still hold both the White House and Senate. Don't let these cynical partisans rip away the most important achievement of your life, sitting next to six Republican-appointed justices in a perpetual minority until you expire. Ignore the haters. So that's it for us. You've been listening to a National U podcast. Any rebroadcast, retransmission, or count this game without the express written permission of National U magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes us sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Noah. Thank you, MBD. Thanks to Patriot Voices and Moink. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors. We'll see you next time.